It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. When it's cold and snowy outside, you might think it's time to recreate indoors or even snuggle up by the fire. But if so, why live in Alaska? Our state is all about snow and ice, and winter is the best time to get around because you don't have to worry about the swamps, alders, and brush that block your path in the summer. Instead, we've got all this beautiful snow, so why not go camping? With the right knowledge and equipment, you can be warm and out there in one of the most spectacular places on Earth. And we've got a couple of experienced winter campers with us right now to talk about it and to talk about the gear you need and how you learn how to do it. Mark Haldane works at REI. He teaches snowshoeing there. He sells equipment that people need. And thanks for being with us, Mark.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And Paul Tordock is the professor and department chair of outdoor studies at APU. Very impressive title.
Thanks, Charles. Good to be here again.
And you you teach people winter camping all the time.
Yeah. I haven't in a few years. It's a younger person's sport, but yeah, I've done a Resurrection Pass with groups. I don't know, 15 times over the years. Yeah.
There's a fear factor people have. I imagine it's the step one is like we're actually going to sleep out there in the cold.
Yeah. It's an amazing place. I mean, I remember when I was in my 20s in Wyoming having this epiphany moment of being warm and comfortable and well-fed and well-hydrated, you know, standing out in the Wind River Mountains in Wyoming under the stars going, this is really cool.
Yeah.
It's like one of those things that you work really hard at. Getting to this certain point, and whether it's skiing through the trees on the Res Pass or tracking an animal through powder. One of the amazing things about winter is all the tracks you see in the animals that are out there. They're much more in some ways. In some ways, they're more visible through their tracks. Otherwise, they're all. On the other hand, they're very well camouflaged. But then just that moment, there's those epiphany moments out there in winter camp I find very unique to the sport. And so getting to that point is a challenge and requires a lot of preparation.
Yeah, well, it requires a sort of a mental change of attitude because we're so used to thinking of only the summer season being the time to do, outdoor stuff. I mean, we ski and we snowshoe a bit, but in general, all the campgrounds shut down on Labor Day, all the boats get put away, sort of people kind of change gears, and not too many people are out there camping in the wintertime in Alaska.
No, not at all. And I think one of the challenges here in Alaska, obviously, is the daylight and the cold and the weather. And so there's a lot of intimidating factors. However, really, I tell people, start with small steps. I mean, there's no reason you can't just go out in your backyard. And I have friends that do this with their kids all the time. Set up a tent, build a little snow shelter, and safety is right there. You're not worried about avalanches. You're not worried about animals. You're not worried about anything. And you can go and have fun. And halfway through the night, you're like, I'm cold. You just go inside.
Right.
And so that little mini first step of trying it out, and then just sort of take, maybe then you go car camping, right? Then you go someplace where you can just pull off and the car's right there. And if things aren't going well, you hop in the car and warm up or, go down to Kirdwood and, get a hotel room or whatever. And then eventually, you maybe move a little farther away from the trailhead. And then eventually maybe you go to a cabin where there's a nice warm cabin nearby that has a wood stove in it. But you're still camping outside. So, you can cook inside. You can have that sort of safety net of a warm, dry place to be. And then eventually, I've become a big fan of these heated tents that they have. We use one called a Kafaru that's a heated teepee that's made out of Colorado. They make them all kinds of different sizes, and APU uses it. We just started using them last year, and I think we have one that can sleep 12. And the whole thing with the stove weighs maybe 15 pounds.
And we're going to have somebody on to talk about that in the second half from Fairbanks, where they're actually making these Arctic oven tents. And
That's a locally
manufactured one. Yeah. So, Mark, you work at REI. Do you get people coming in sort of saying, "Gee, I'd like to try this. What do I need to know?" That in terms of like getting out in the winter and sleeping outdoors, or do most people come in? They already sort of have the expertise.
Living in Alaska, we do have quite a few people that seem already familiar with the winter. A lot of folks come in with their kids that are getting into scouting and have to do their winter camp out.
Oh, yeah.
And I have a bit of empathy for those parents because they're finding out how expensive it is to be comfortable in the winter and camp
right.
out. It's good to hear Paul talk about taking the small steps because it's been so many years since I've first started winter camping that I'd forgotten. And I actually didn't do that. I just kind of jumped right in. But I grew up in Alaska, so I had an idea of all the gear that it took. And, you know, there's a saying, there's no such thing as bad weather, just bad gear. And it does take a fair amount of gear to stay warm and comfortable and mm-hmm. have fun in the outdoors. But I love winter, and the peace and serenity of camping out in the winter is great. And I actually don't think I've ever been cold camping out in the winter.
I know. I've been cold ice climbing. There's a special beauty and sort of peacefulness out there. There's no other people. There's no bugs, which I think is like my number one favorite thing about it.
Yeah.
And it's just gorgeous. I mean, Alaska is much more beautiful in the winter than in the summer. It's beautiful all the time, but in the winter, I just think it's so, so gorgeous. And that feeling of waking up in the morning and just going out and just everything is smooth and white yeah. and there's nobody else around. What could be better?
Yeah, that's right.
So, in terms of gear, I mean, one of the issues with winter camping is you have a lot of gear and really you don't want to be carrying that much stuff on your back. But if you're skiing or snowshoeing, you can pull it in a sled. If you're on a snow machine, obviously you don't have that big of an issue. Is that what most people do, pulling stuff?
Well, I go back and forth if the terrain's pretty flat, if you're not going far, yeah, a sled, a little poke, plastic poke is great. And you can put, you can't overload them. You can put maybe 30 or 40 pounds on them. Otherwise, you'll get too top heavy and tippy. And then the rest in a pack. If the terrain's steep, if I'm going up to a hut somewhere or somewhere where there's some traversing, the sleds become a bit of a bother. So mm-hmm. I'll try to fit everything into a pack.
What's your sense, Mark? I know you teach snowshoeing. Are most people going out on snowshoes or on skis? Hard to tell, I guess. Probably.
Yeah, I don't really know the answer to that. Probably both. Mm-hmm. When it came to my winter camping, I've actually done more skiing than I have the snowshoeing. Mm-hmm. And a lot of my classes are geared towards the folks just getting into it, so a lot of day tripping.
So you're teaching people how to snowshoe.
Yeah, and the differences in the snowshoes these days, because they've changed so much just in the last 12, 15 years compared to the old days. And part of the reason I enjoy teaching it, and I always start my classes off saying, I think I'm the guy to give it, because I grew up a skier, totally poo-pooing snowshoes. But I've come to realize their virtues and their ease of use. And any kind of footwear you already own can work in a snowshoe. We have plans, paper plans that we give out to folks that want to make their own sled if they want to tow their gear.
Uh-huh.
And that's another change in recent years is the gear itself. It's gotten smaller, more compact, and lighter weight.
Mm-hmm.
Although winter gear is still pretty bulky and having to carry extra fuel to melt snow and things like that. And one of the biggest things I always want to make sure people know is two good pads underneath you. Because
mm-hmm.
I still haven't camped out in one of these heated tents yet, and I don't do much cabin yet.
Yeah, yeah. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth, and we're talking about winter camping and snowshoeing here in Alaska. And my guests are Paul Tordock, who's a professor at Alaska Pacific University teaching outdoor studies, and Mark Haldane from REI. He teaches snowshoeing and sells all the gear we're talking about. Let's talk about snowshoes for a minute, Mark. You mentioned that snowshoes have changed. They've gotten smaller. They're pretty easy to use these days.
They're very easy, and that's one of the changes almost every year is the bindings as the manufacturers try to make them easier to get in and out of just for convenience, because if something's a hassle, you're going to be less likely to want to do it. And that's the biggest change is the bindings, how secure your foot is in the binding and how maintenance-free the snowshoe is.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to use whatever footwear temperature dictates that you probably already own, so you don't have to have special shoes like you do skiing. And then the ease of travel, I say it's a mindless activity like wandering through the woods like a moose. You can just go anywhere over hill and dale without having to navigate up a hill at a certain angle and go around.
Now, there's different, I mean, there are different types of snowshoes for different applications these days, right?
Well, it's what you're thinking of there is mostly just the aggressiveness of the crampon underneath the snowshoe itself. The snowshoes for steeper terrain are going to have a lot more aggressive crampon underfoot just for more traction. Although even the most recreational of the snowshoes that are can be under $100 have a real good crampon underfoot for traction. And that's another big change compared to the old ones that had nothing underneath. And and part of the reason the snowshoes are smaller these days is because the solid decking gives you a little more flotation. But and 36 inches is as big as you can even buy in the newer style snowshoes these days.
Yeah, the old ones used to be pretty large.
Yep, they did.
So you said something we never hear on the show, which is under $100. Everything, $100, I didn't even know those bills under $100 were good for anything anymore. So it's not expensive to rig, get yourself a decent pair of snowshoes.
No, it sure doesn't have to be. And then we rent them. And
oh, really?
Yep.
So you can just try it out and go out to the park and walk around.
Yep. And speaking of parks, you know, they're going to have Saturday intro to snowshoeing classes here.
Yeah, we'll be talking about that during our calendar segment. Yep. So do you feel like, and I guess throw this open to you, Paul, too, it's if you're going out skiing or do you take snowshoes along or just not worry about snowshoeing if you're skiing?
Well, keep it simple to start with is my recommendation to people. It's a fairly complex and can be, like Mark said, expensive endeavor. There's, in some reason, no reason why a good pair of warm hiking boots and some gaiters, and if you're just walking little ways, won't work for you. Mm-hmm. And then you have good equipment and know how to use it. I think if you don't have some gear, if you have a good gear and you don't know how to use it, it's not going to do you a bit of good. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't really matter whether you're skiing or snowshoeing. Snowshoeing, if you are not a skier, put in a pack on your back, raises your center of gravity and makes it way more challenging.
Yeah,
I teach junior Nordic once in a while with you occasionally, I tell my kids, "Well, you got to fall down 10,000 times to be an Olympian, you know, or something like that." And then I say, "Well, put a pack on your back; it'll increase your number of times you're going to fall a lot." So if you're not a skier, definitely start with walking or snowshoeing. And if you are a skier, use a pair that are very stable and you're very comfortable with and know how to use.
Right. So what are the sort of the basic things that you would tell somebody to do? We're talking about introducing somebody to winter camping. Yeah. Mark brought up having two pads, so you keep the cold to the ground away from yourself. Do you want to see the two of you, see if we can come up with a list of items?
Well, I think on everybody's mind is staying warm, and so I think the things that we don't think about sometimes are hydration and food. Mm-hmm. And so, it's not a place to go on a diet. You really need to be. I mean, a typical person, I'll be burning 1,200 to 2,000 calories a day, and you just double that when you go in the winter environment.
And people don't appreciate that it's not because of the athletic effort you're putting in. It's because your body is burning tons of calories just to stay warm.
Stay warm, yeah.
So you don't have to be doing anything, and you're still going to burn 10 tons more calories.
Yep. And the body will adapt. I mean, the first day or two, it'll be like, wait a minute, where's my bed? Where's my, where's the thermostat at? And then after a couple of days, it'll go, oh, I know what the thermostat is. It's in my belly. And so it'll start to demand more fat, basically.
And if you don't eat, you're going to get cold.
Yep. And hydration is super important because of water loss through vapor. You're out in a very dry environment, so you breathe out a lot of moisture. Just that alone, you need to up your water intake. And the food and the water has to be tasty. I mean, it has to be something you like to eat and you know how to cook. So those are the first things I start with.
So let's, and I don't want to, I know I asked you for a list, but in terms of the food, you're looking for high-dense, high-calorie items. High fat?
High fat. And typically, breakfast to start off with something which is, because you haven't eaten at breakfast, you know, you really haven't eaten for maybe up to 12 hours. Maybe you ate at 7 or 8 at night, mm-hmm. and now it's 8 in the morning. And so your body, that's the low point. So I'll even go to bed with a candy bar or a chocolate cheese or something. Mm-hmm. So in the middle of the night, I wake up a little cold. I'll eat a little bit. I'll chew, have something that is sort of yummy and has some calories in it. And then I wake up in the morning and immediately start hydrating, getting water in. Melting snow, getting the water bottles full, and then having a big pot of something hot with a lot of sugar, because sugar gives you instant energy, and then margarine, butter, whatever kind of fat mm-hmm. that you like. And then, lunchtime, then I always say, well, lunch starts right after breakfast is over. Right. And immediately, you start eating. And every hour, you're stopping, snacking, having water, and that's whatever tastes good to you. You know, nuts, gorp type stuff, candy bars, power bars, whatever you eat. And then when you're in a camp, I have another snack to give me the energy to set up camp. And then a big bowl of cheesy pasta or something right. that's got a lot of fat in it to get me through the night.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And all along, liquids.
And you can melt the snow, but you have to have a stove that will yeah. function well yeah. in the wintertime. What kind of stove do you recommend, Mark?
White gas. The propane butane canisters aren't going to be very good much below freezing. Or
the propane
below
zero. Just doesn't seem to work in real cold.
Well, though. The propane will, but the canisters you buy are a blend of propane butane.
Mm-hmm.
So the first half will burn better than the second half in cold weather.
I don't like those things at any time.
Well, I use them a lot in the summer and spring because no spilt fuel, no carbon buildup on anything you own. Great uh-huh. flame adjustment. Uh-huh. But I sure agree with everything Paul said, especially about the hydration, and I remind everybody about that daily, because a lot of folks aren't used to a dry environment as we have when you're out in the winter. And the food intake, I know a lot of people add butter to all their soups they ever mm-hmm. make when they're outdoors. And then you mentioned stoves for melting water, and that's a trick too, is boiling up some water, filling up your Nalgene, throwing it in the foot of your sleeping bag mm-hmm. so it stays liquid overnight, and then you've got water to start boiling when you wake up.
And you're going to want your drinks to be warm, and throw some Gatorade or something in my opinion, just so that you want to drink it and you're not chilling yourself every time you drink it.
Make sure you experiment with your own taste buds before you go in, both solid and drink. So yeah. And a lot of times I'll lessen the ingredients because my taste buds seemed heightened, so mm-hmm. the recommended might be too rich and too strong. Mm-hmm.
All right, so what's the next item on our list, Paul?
Gear. Well, it's a long list, but I think clothing, it's a pretty basic list no matter what season you're on. A couple layers of, it's all non-cotton clothing. And so a couple polypro type or even silk tops, long john tops and bottoms, 3 or 4 pair of wool or wool blend, synthetic blend socks, good hat, good pair of fleece gloves, and then some sort of wind layers over that, and then maybe a pile jacket, and then a big puffy on top of that.
It's like a down parka.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then on your feet.
Your objective in some level is, like, if you were completely stationary and just sitting there, you'd still be warm.
Right. If you're well fed. I mean,
right.
I love this quote. I don't know who said it first, but there's no such thing as a warm jacket or a warm sleeping bag. You have to be warm. Mm-hmm. It doesn't produce heat. So
that's the toughest time if you're sitting still.
Yeah.
There are. I love, Mark mentioned the hot water bottle trick. Boy, it's just great. I mean, I right when I go to the camp, I get a hot water bottle in my parka or in my, when I go to bed in my sleeping bag, that's external warmth, and that's mm-hmm. a fantastic thing to have. A nice pair of Dacron. I usually go with Dacron. I tend to shy away from down products in Alaska, especially in South Central. Mm-hmm. Fairbanks for sure, down's fine. And the interior. South Central, as we've seen this last week, it can rain. We just had a group come in from Turnagain Pass on last Friday, I think, and they were soaked. I mean, they were just, they'd been out in the rain, and they're all wondering where the rain here was at. And so I like the Dacron because once down gets wet, it loses its insulation value.
It's almost worthless. Yeah,
and it's hard to dry out. And so Dacron booties, even some Dacron puffy pants, a puffy jacket with a a big hood on it, and even puffy over mitts, you know, so just a big fluff ball when you're standing around out there.
Mm-hmm. Now, you need something to put on your feet when you're done with the day so that the boots can dry out.
Yep. Yeah, so the Dacron booties, and they'll even make over booties. Mark's probably got a better idea what models are out there nowadays. But yeah, you just, you know, get a dry pair of socks on. One thing I do want to comment on, it when you go to bed or at some point during the day, you want to try to get everything, especially your feet, dried out. If your feet are wet and damp all the time, you risk a thing called trench foot, which is not a freezing injury, but a circulation nervous injury to your feet, which is very painful and debilitating.
And the dampness itself will chill you as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Outdoor Explorer, I'm Charles Wolforth. We're talking about winter camping and snowshoeing with Paul Twardock, the professor at APU, and Mark Haldane from REI. Mark, just the stuff that Paul was just listing, you are probably over $1,000 for the really warm parka, the puffy pants, the multiple layers of long underwear. If you spend any time outdoors, you probably have some of this already. But in terms of the just sitting still and staying warm outdoors, you might not, because, you know, a lot of skiers, they anticipate being active. You know, snow machine riders might have that stuff because they're sitting pretty still. But in terms of like the stuff that's going to keep you warm at the end of the day, it's expensive stuff, right?
It does add up. I would think you could get by under $1,000 though if you shop. You know, don't run out and buy it all at once, but look for sales and accumulate it. I like to throw in, instead of a hat, I go through different thicknesses of balaclavas, depending on my activity and the temperature out there. I love those things because you wear them like a hat or pull them over your face so you're breathing moist, damp air or warm, damp air.
And you can also wear earbuds with them without your earlobes freezing. You know, if you wear earbuds with just a regular hat, the lower part of your ear gets cold, but with the balaclava, it stays warm.
I was going to say about the cost, Charles, that I did had a student once go through and price, I'll just say it, walk into REI with your credit card, and they priced a list of everything, including tent, sleeping bags, you know, everything. And it was like $3,000+ just to go in and buy stuff new. And then I had them go around to Value Village, Salvation Army, get online, and like try to go to the low end. And it was around $900. Craigslist. I mean, I said, okay, I'll give a prize for the student that comes out with the least expensive, but still functional, list.
And, okay, but the missing element there is knowledge, because I shop at REI, I start up at AMH. I know there's cheaper places to buy stuff, but if I want to get a pair of shoes that has just or a pair of skis with just the right flex, or I don't know all that much about it, then I need the salesman Mark, who's going to help me figure it out, right?
Yeah,
and then
hopefully.
Sure, that's sort of your value added there.
Yeah, hopefully figure out what's going to work the best for you without breaking the bank.
And there's a different, if you're climbing Mount McKinley, is different than if you're just going up to Turnagain Pass, right? And what's the yes or no?
Oh, yeah. Well,
that's part of asking the customer, what do you intend to do? And I encourage them to think in the future, what do they aspire to do someday?
Right, you don't want to buy low-end equipment and then find out you got to buy new equipment.
We've had groups down at Kenai at -40, at Denali-like conditions, and windy.
Right.
And so, yeah, you're not at altitude, but this is in January typically. So generally, yeah, it's a very different, entirely different environment. But in the middle of winter, it can be just as brutal. Down at Turnagain Pass, and it is anywhere in North America, really.
What about footwear and keeping your feet warm? There's different philosophies on how to go on footwear for wintertime activities where, we're remembering that there's going to be an active portion of your day when you're moving, and then there's going to be a less active portion of the day when you're in camp. How do you feel about bunny boots, Paul?
They're heavy. That's how I feel about them. I mean, I think for snow machining and for possibly snowshoeing, they're great. But I think there's a lot, a huge variety of super lightweight, very warm boots that primarily mushers actually have pioneered and manufactured that are a lot lighter. Bunny boots are great if you're going to be in water, though. I mean, if there's any chance of getting into water, they're the thing to have.
Now, you mentioned bunny boots with snowshoes. a lot of folks nowadays that are new to Alaska, of course, don't even know what a bunny boot is. And if somebody is thinking about snowshoeing and buying snowshoes to fit bunny boots, I encourage them to bring them in because your manufacturers don't make quite as long of straps anymore.
We're not used to that, yeah.
And I used to say that the bindings would fit anything all the way up to a bunny boot, but not so much anymore. So you want to make sure you can even get a boot that big.
Mm-hmm. What do you spend for a really good boot that you feel confident with when you're out winter camping?
Why? $250?
Yeah, that's an...
Yeah, I'm a skier, so I'm using ski boots that run anywhere from, you know, $250 to $400. Mm-hmm. I like boots with removable liners. Mm-hmm. So when I get into camp, I could put on my puffy little my Dacron camp booty, mm-hmm. and then take that liner out and stick it under my parka and immediately start to dry it. And even with the insole, I'll take the insole out, and that goes everywhere with me. It goes in under my parka right when I'm going to camp, and it's in there until I wake up in the morning, or I'll go to sleep with it, and hopefully by the morning it'll get some semblance of dryness.
Yeah. Well, this is a great topic. I'm really enjoying it, and thank both of my guests who are here. Paul Twardock, you just heard, he's a professor of outdoor studies at APU, and Mark Haldane with REI. And we're going to be back in the second half talking more about extreme winter camping. We have a guest who manufactures tents that are used in the high Arctic, and a lot more about winter camping, what you might want to try, and also sort of what are the pitfalls and the things to be careful of. So that's all coming up. Stay with us. But right now it's time for the Outdoor Explorer Calendar. The Cordova Ice Worm Festival is coming up Monday, February 3rd through Saturday, February 9th. In the annual survival suit race, groups of locals race down the docks, jump into survival gear, and dive into the icy harbor waters. The Ice Worm Variety Show features local performers and is the stage for the Miss Ice Worm coronation. The parade is a procession of excitement as the Ice Worm makes its yearly appearance. The Ice Worm Festival began in Cordova in 1961 and continues to welcome guests from all over the world. For more info, go to CordovaChamber.com. Looking for places to go snowshoeing around Anchorage, or perhaps a little uneasy about going out by yourself? Join the Anchorage Parks and Recreation instructor, Eric Mank, for a guided snowshoe tour at the Campbell Creek Estuary this Saturday, January 25th at 12 p.m. If you can't make it this weekend, snowshoe hikes will continue every Saturday through March 22nd at a different park in Anchorage. The cost is $15. And pre-registration is required. For more info and to sign up, click on Parks and Recreation at muni.org or call 343-6992. Wolf Run 2014 is this Saturday, January 25th. In the 5K costume run, Red Riding Hoods and Three Little Pigs get a head start, and the wolves try to catch them to remove their life flags. Prizes for the most flags gathered and for the fastest Red Riding Hoods and Three Little Pigs. Everyone dresses up. The 5K starts at 11 a.m. and the non-costumed half marathon starts at 10 a.m., both from UAA. Proceeds for this run benefit UAA's Architecture and Engineering Club and their Habitat for Humanity efforts. Finally, the 18th annual Alaska Ski for Women is Sunday, February 2nd. To tell us more about this year's events, we have with us by phone race director Fiona Peachell. Hi, Fiona.
Hi, Charles.
So, I know the Super Bowl must be in the offing because the Ski for Women is coming up, and the two are on the same day for reasons that are traditional, I suppose. It was started that way long ago.
Absolutely. It started that day by the Nordic Ski Association, by two ladies that were trying to find an open day on the calendar. There were no other races, and it just happened to be Super Bowl Sunday that year, and the tradition just kind of continued from there.
And the race is over by the time the game starts, typically, I think.
Absolutely. We, especially with our volunteers, you know, and the racers, we make sure you're home in time.
So, and I always go skiing on Super Bowl Sunday afternoon because there's no one else on the trails, but that's just me. The other thing about the race that's unique is it's a really big race. There are lots of people in it, but most of the people there are really not competing in terms of how fast they go.
Absolutely. We have the timed races, and within those races, we have all the categories from slow to very fast. And so we divide everyone up so nobody gets trampled. And at least half of the 1,300 women that and kids that do it are participating in the party wave, which is non-timed, totally fun. Costumes are crazy. It's just a great time for whatever you want out of the race.
In the last 5 years or so, the costumes have really gone over the top, haven't they?
They absolutely have. It's pretty crazy when you see U-Haul vans driving up to the Kincaid Chalet because their costumes don't fit in cars.
Yeah, really. Yeah. So how did that tradition get started, or do you know?
The tradition of the costume, just people just started doing it on their own. They just wanted to be a little crazy. And then as it evolved each year, one of our race directors, Shannon Uffenbeck, she said, hey, let's do, you know, a costume contest. You know, let's really encourage this. And so it just kind of, you know, grew every year, and it's just grown since then. And it's, you know, just, it's a great fun race for a lot of women that would never participate otherwise in a ski race. And they, you know, have fun costumes. Some are super elaborate, like you commented on, and some are just, you know, by the time I'm there, I put on a pink headband and I go with my girlfriends and we're like, we're good to go.
Mm-hmm. Well, I, last year, a bunch of my daughter's friends got together, and it was like a 2 or 3 day affair of all the costume preparation and work and all these neighborhood kids gathering together. And that was part of the fun, was the long period of preparation and excitement leading up to the race.
Absolutely. A lot of the groups have grown and they've become bigger and they're planning ahead of time. And they're even, you know, at the race, they'll be at the race this year thinking about what they're going to do next year. So it's really fun to see that kind of excitement.
Tough job for the judges, I would think.
Yeah, it is. It is. And we've got three categories. We do a team, we do best duo, and last year we added one for best kids. And we've got a lot of little kids, medium kids, like you say, your daughter's age, where they create their own costumes, and it's great to see them starting out so young.
Uh-huh. Great. So it is a fundraiser, though. It's not just fun.
Absolutely. It's a fundraiser for stopping the cycle of domestic violence in Alaska. And last year we gave out $60,500 worth of grants. Excuse me.
$60,000. That's amazing. Just from one race.
It is. We have sponsorship money, and it comes from all the registration donations, from merchandise, and we have continual grant recipients that apply every year, like Awake and Standing Up Against Rape, YWCA, and then last year we contributed to the New Claire House and a new program called Running Free Alaska, which helps inmates at Highland Correctional Center do a running program to help rehabilitate themselves, and when they get back in the community, strive and keep going on a positive note.
That's wonderful. So how do folks sign up for the race?
They can go to AlaskaSkiForWomen.org and go to the registration page, and they can do it online until next Wednesday night. And if they don't get it done then, we have 2 days of registration in person and bib pickup at REI next Thursday, January 30th and Friday, January 31st. From 12 noon until 7:30 p.m. at REI. And if they're really last stragglers, they can pick up their bib Sunday morning and they can register for the non-timed party wave. So we don't want to exclude anyone. We want to get them in there any way we can.
Got you. And what time does it actually begin?
The first race is at 10:30 a.m. And the party wave goes, and they do the skate, then the classic, and then the costume parade starts about 11:45, and we try and get it, the party wave off by 12:15. And, you know, that's a little weather dependent. We're hoping, you know, the weather gods cooperate with us.
And parking. Parking seems like it's a significant issue for this event.
Absolutely. Parking, the best thing that people can note is to give themselves plenty of time. We have two charter buses donated from Premier Tours Alaska that start shuttling racers from Kincaid Park Elementary and all the lots along the way. And obviously the chalet lot fills up very quickly in the morning. And so participants are highly encouraged to give themselves a lot of time and to carpool and just make sure that they're not in a rush when they get there.
Yeah, don't get there at the last minute because you're liable to miss it the parking is such an issue.
Yeah.
All right, great. And in terms of like who signs up, if you could just stay up on your skis for a short little ski and wear a silly costume, that's the only requirement. You don't have to be a great skier.
Absolutely not. I'm not a great skier at all. And it's only 2.4 miles. It's an easy course. There's, you know, lots of people out there. So it's when you're in the party wave, especially, it's not a race. You are out there enjoying the day, enjoying the camaraderie, and just having a good time.
All right.
A great cause.
Well, thanks so much for being with us, Fiona. The 18th annual Alaska Ski for Women is coming up Sunday, February 2nd. And you can find out more information and a link to the Ski for Women on our website at alaskapublic.org. You'll also find links to all the other events we mentioned on the calendar today. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. Stick around for the second half of the show. We'll continue to talk about winter camping and snowshoeing when Outdoor Explorer continues.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer from KSKA Anchorage. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and iTunes. To see what's coming up on future programs and add your voice to the conversation, go to alaskapublic.org.
We're back. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and our topic today is winter camping and snowshoeing and having fun and staying warm all year long in this incredible place that we have to recreate. In the studio with me are Paul Tordock, who's professor at Alaska Pacific University in the Outdoor Studies Program, and Mark Haldane from REI. And now joining us from Fairbanks is Dave Atchison with Alaska Tent and Tarp. Thanks for being with us, Dave.
You're welcome. I'm glad to be here.
So I got interested in talking to you when we had a previous guest on, Matthew Sturm, who has done these incredible snow machine expeditions all across Alaska and all the way across Alaska through Canada. And people swear by your tents as a way to stay really warm in extremely cold weather. And I guess they're used for Arctic expedition probably at both ends of the world. Tell us about the Arctic oven tent and what makes it unusual.
Well, the concept came about 25 years ago or so in interior Alaska, where we get severe cold, and what materials could be improved on to be able to be out in those conditions that you were describing earlier. So it was kind of a development process of materials and quality materials, and then we ended up developing some new materials to the market that allow us to provide a condensation-free interior, and that's really the integral part of the system is if you're dry, it's much easier to stay warm.
Mm-hmm. So you have some fabric that's a proprietary fabric that has this capacity to avoid the condensation inside?
Yes, and we developed that fabric about 20 years ago now, and it's been a really unique piece to the puzzle of the common tent versus what we call the Arctic oven tent. They may look similar, but the functionality of it's completely different.
Mm-hmm. So how does that work exactly?
Well, what it does is it allows you to be inside of the tent and allow any moisture that's inside of the tent to transport through that material without freezing or condensing onto the inside, and any moisture that may drip back onto the body of the tent, it keeps it from transporting back in. So you could really sleep right against the wall inside of an Arctic oven, even in the wettest conditions, that moisture won't come back in that's been transported out in the form of vapor. So it's pretty unique that way.
Hmm. And the configuration of the fly over the tent sounds a little bit different in the way you get dead airspace between the fly and the tent. Tell us about that as well.
Yeah, it's a design, and once again, it's a system. So all these components work together to provide this dry area. What we do is we have extra long snow flaps that go down all the way onto the ground, and we also create about a 6 to 8 inch space between the body and the fly of the tent with the frame design. And so when that fly is staked out or tied down or buried at the bottom, it creates a dead airspace. And so you don't have air traveling between the body and the fly. It's stationary air, and it's much easier, and it definitely has an insulating property if that air is stationary. So with a stove inside of the tent at, you know, just as an example, we do testing here, 50 below zero outside with a stove, with even a small fire in it, you can achieve temperatures of 75 degrees plus with very little effort with very small stove inside.
So you're selling the sheet metal stoves that you can use wood with, and you can essentially, they're pretty light to pack, and so then you can set up your tent, and you've got sort of an indoor environment.
Sure, and you know, multi-fuel stoves, so whatever fuel source you may have available to you to burn in your stove is what you want to use. So like you mentioned, a lightweight sheet metal stove, which may burn wood, a small propane stove, and even in moderate temperatures, anything down to 0 degrees, you could just use like a regular propane buddy heater, which doesn't cause an issue in our tent because of that interior material, where in a different type, say if you used a propane stove in a wall tent, you would definitely notice condensation on the inside of your wall tent freezing to the inside of the wall.
Mm-hmm. How does the smoke, if you're using like a wood stove, how does the smoke get out of the tent?
Yeah, we use a stove pipe, and we put a stove jack standard in the tent. So, you know, the tent component system incorporates the thought that you're going to use a wood stove or a propane stove with a stove pipe in it. So we go ahead and put stove jacks in the tent.
Huh, interesting. So who's using these tents? I know they're not cheap. They're a high-end product.
Yeah, we kind of have I don't know if I'd call it a niche market, because we seem to find new uses for them all the time. But so we would have, you know, the obvious ones, snow machiners, snowshoe people, maybe backcountry skiers, heli ski camps. We've got research stations on the North Slope in Alaska, Greenland, Antarctica. They use them for housing. We have some larger tent designs. We have about 13 models now. So some of the larger designs, they may use them for something like a laboratory out on an ice field, because they are pretty efficient to heat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's amazing. And I'm always excited, and I like to highlight these products that are invented and created in Alaska. You know, there's an extraordinary number of them. And I think it's because we face more extreme conditions, and we have challenges that people maybe don't think about elsewhere. And then we also have, I think, have some people with exceptional ingenuity and entrepreneurial spirit who go out and do it. So it's great.
Yeah, I remember using the Arctic oven first time. I don't know, it's like the Copper River dog sled race, and I had a bunch of friends trying out, and we had one, and it was great. It was like we'd fire up that stove, and like I said, it was warm. Like in 5 minutes, we had that thing heated up, and we're all comfy and cozy. They're fantastic products.
Yeah, very cool.
Yeah.
So we've got your website on our website, alaskapublic.org, Dave. So I want to thank you very much for being with us, Dave Atchison with Alaska Tent and Tarp up in Fairbanks.
You bet, anytime. Yeah, visit us at alaskatent.com.
All right, thank you. So back here in the studio, Paul Twardock from APU and Mark Haldane from REI. What are other tent choices? I mean, obviously, we've sort of talked a lot about Dave's tent. It's a very expensive tent, and it's for somebody who really is going to be dealing with low temperatures and needs that. But you don't have to buy the most expensive tent. Mark, I mean, what are your kind of recommendations you make for somebody who maybe is more starting out rather than heading to the North Pole?
Well, a winter tent is going to be more expensive, and there aren't that many to choose from. And what makes it a winter tent or four-season tent is less netting, less mosquito netting. As you mentioned, you don't want much, if any, wind blowing through your tent. And there's going to have a fly that comes farther down, closer to the door, and bigger vestibule to store your gear or cook in. So it's going to be heavier and a lot more expensive than your two- or three-season tents.
Mm-hmm. Does it have, he uses a special fabric. Is that something that's happened in other tents, or are they mostly just using the same normal fabric?
Same fabrics, just more of it. Mm-hmm. And more poles to support a snow load and a wind load, and then more guy points, which are really critical mm-hmm. on the outside of the tent. You want to make sure you guy them all out. We talked about condensation and moisture, and no matter what the season, you sure want to make sure your tent's well guide out so that your fly does not touch the body of the tent anywhere, because that's where you'll get a leak.
Right. Talk more about shelter, Paul. I mean, tenting, you need to obviously be prepared for wind and also for not that much backup if you're in the backcountry in the wintertime.
Yeah. So I'm a big fan of snow shelters. They're as warm as you can get. I mean, you can get down into the snow, and there could be minus 40 and blowing like a banshee out there, and you can be snug as a bug in your snow cave, or what we call Quincy, a big pile of snow that you've dug out. And they're fun to build. Kids love to mess with them. They're sort of a little architectural bit of ingenuity going on, having the dome shape to keep it upright.
I absolutely agree with that. Probably the warmest and the quietest I've ever slept outdoors was in a snow cave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there are some work, and there's a lot of different types to make. I've used tarps, a really low end. If you want to go cheap, I used to go camping with our APU classes. I'd say, you need a tarp. And we'd take a tarp in snow shelters. And that worked pretty well until one trip we got about 4 inches of rain down in Turkington Pass. And since then, we brought a nice dome tent along because everybody got pretty wet.
Everybody's lying in a puddle, I guess.
I woke up and the top of the snow shelter was about 2 inches from my face. And I was like, let me out of here pretty fast. And like I said earlier in the show, we've gone to these heated tents. The Arctic ovens are great. They're pretty heavy for hauling on just if you've got a pack. And so we've gone to lighter nylon shelters that, we use a manufacturer called Kafura. And they're not cheap. They're pretty expensive. But they got, again, these aluminum stoves are great. You can throw a bunch of wood in there. And last year we had a group out we don't know how cold it got because the thermometer bottomed out at minus 20. And we know that the thermometers up in Chickalin were hitting minus 40, and they're up at Caribou Creek. And, they managed, and mostly due to the shelter with the wood stove. They're able to get everybody in there, dried out, warmed up, and that helped a lot. Mm-hmm.
Doesn't sound like much fun, though.
You know, it's in the fun factor. You know, fun factor four is when you didn't have a lot of fun doing it. And the only fun involved is in the telling of the story afterwards, or even your friends laughing at you that you did it.
Right.
So I think that was that case. That everybody learned a lot and was glad it was over with when it was done.
Yeah, when you're with a group and everybody comes through unscathed, I think you always look back at it as being a good time with a group.
No, that's a fact. You know, when I've sort of been in scrapes, then you get the burst of pleasure, then you're out of the scrape. That's true. But then you don't necessarily want to get in another scrape.
Yeah. Well, you learn. Hopefully you learn. And, you know, maybe next time go where there are cabins or something where it's going to be a little bit warmer.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. We're talking about winter camping with Paul Tordock from APU and Mark Haldane from REI. Before we run out of time, I want to make sure, Paul, that we and also Mark, if you have anything to throw in here, resources that people can get, because they are going to need to learn a little bit more than what we can tell them on the radio, where you can get more information and learn more about it.
Yeah. So, you can get on the web and everything's there. I just looked up Backpacker Magazine has a pretty good website at backpacker.com that has some tutorials that I found right on. They've interviewed people from the National Outdoor Leadership School and other schools that do a lot of this kind of stuff. So I found that information fairly accurate and useful. There's some books. Again, the National Outdoor Leadership School has a book on winter camping written by John Gukim. Falcon Guides, Falcon Publishing, has a series of books, one by Molly Absalon, who's a former Knowles instructor, and another one by Alan O'Bannon, who is also a former Knowles instructor, who are both very useful guides to winter camping. There's a bunch of other great ones out there.
Mm-hmm.
Another big challenge is finding where to go, actually. I have students all the time who go, I just want to go winter camping. And they don't have a car or they haven't. It's hard in the Anchorage Bowl to actually find a place to go. In fact, you pretty much can't. You can't camp on Muni Parkland or in a camel track. So you end up in a state park, and in state parks you're supposed to get more or less a half mile away from a road. To park. There are campgrounds that are closed that you might be able to use. For instance, Bradley Kepler I'm not sure about Indian or Bird, the status of that down there.
But it's been under construction.
Yeah, it's been under construction. So I don't know. I suppose you could camp and just walk in there and camp. And then the forest, the National Forest down in Turnagain Pass and Curdwood area. Once you get up in the mountains, we're not talking about avalanches. I think we had an avalanche show. But once you get into any terrain at all, then you need to be educated with avalanches. And there's a lot of resources out there to learn how to do that.
Right. So when you can't camp in the city parks, but you could camp in the state park and you stay half a mile off the road.
Yep.
I'm just going to say, this may not be the point of view of Alaska public media, but I don't think anybody's actually going to come and hassle you if you're.
No,
like,
I don't think so. No. I mean, I'm just staying in the reds, but I'm pretty sure I've had some students walk off into a Campbell Track and go camping over the years, and then obviously private land, you just need to get permission before you camp on someone's private land. I mean, I also mentioned there's some classes and other resources, and not a lot. APU, our program does have a winter camping class, though. It's primarily aimed at our fully enrolled students, though. We do have a tuition rate for the general public if they want to check it out. Mm-hmm. And then there's UAF that has a winter camping class. Prince William Sound Community College has a winter camping class. Alaska Mountaineering School out of Tahkeena doesn't specifically offer a winter camping class, but they do glacier travel and mountaineering courses that winter camping is obviously a big part of. And then
meetup groups would be
meetup. The meetup group's another one that you're just getting out with other people with experience. I mean, that's the best way to learn is get a friend who has done it and knows some stuff and go out with them.
Yeah.
I mean,
and we did a show on meetup groups. You can find that show on our site at alaskapublic.org, and that'll have links as to how to find the meetup groups. Or just Google it. That'll work too. And you could do some classes over at REI. I know you teach snowshoeing, right, Mark?
Right. We have had introduction to snowshoe class, and it is just a classroom session, one a month. And I think we have one intro to winter camping sometime during the winter. The meetup group is great. Oh, you mentioned the state parks. Remember your Chugach State Park pass. And then I like to remind locals, if they just want to try snowshoeing, remember the Chester Creek Greenbelt. That's often so swampy in the summer, it's just a winter wonderland so close and accessible here in town.
Yeah, that's a cool thing about snowshoes is that although I'm a fairly skilled skier, when you get out sort of into the woods and sort of where there's a lot of trees around and it's hilly, you know, actually snowshoes are more fun because you can just sort of navigate any way you want to go. And there's lots of places in Anchorage that you'd never, ever go. Because in the summertime, it's brush. And in the wintertime, you're on your skis and you're on the trail. In snowshoes, you can just sort of
go anywhere.
Yeah, go anywhere. Yeah. And I don't know. Let's throw out some places that are fun for snowshoeing in Anchorage. You mentioned Campbell.
Chugach State Park just up behind us.
Yeah. And, you can at Kincaid or out by Point Warrensoff, you can sort of just take off and wander around the woods, too.
Yeah, and Campbell Track's amazing. And even the UMed area, the APU lands and UAA lands, come over and walk around while they last. I mean, with all the road building, potential road building coming up, it's a great time to come over and explore the areas before they get developed.
Mm-hmm. Campbell Creek Estuary and down in the state wildlife refuge down on the shore. I mean, that's a great place in the spring for crest skiing. You can bike out there on the ice. That can be really fun, and it'd be a good place for snowshoeing as well, obviously being careful about falling in the water and stuff.
Yeah, another resource out there I should mention is the Eagle River Visitor Center. I mean, they have a
Eagle River Nature Center.
Nature Center, yeah. They have classes, and they have their yurt and cabin and trail system out there also.
Mm-hmm. So just to finish up here, the ultimate piece of literature about winter camping is Jack London's story, To Build a Fire. You guys both familiar with that story?
Yeah.
It's a pioneer.
It's a little depressing, but
it's a prospector who's a greenhorn. He goes out, it's 40 below or something, and he falls in some overflow, and he has to build a fire, and he makes one tiny mistake after another in the end of the story. Hopefully I'm not spoiling it for anyone. He freezes to death. And so, I mean, that's obvious, kind of don't fall in overflow when it's 40 below and not be prepared. What are some like pitfalls or errors, things that people should be careful of, or maybe there's some stories that we can tell to sort of illustrate things? Do you guys want to pitch in on that?
Frozen water. I mean, water, like whether it's falling through overflow I didn't have a frozen water bottle. When you need hydration and you're cold and your water bottle's frozen, that's a classic mistake. That's a small thing that can add up to the bigger things that come on later, frostbite and so forth.
You're not really going to be able to get it thawed very easily.
It's going to be tough. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And so you have no way of actually gathering water and getting right. water yep. into your body.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So that'd be one. I think
frozen feet are obviously a huge one.
Yeah. Yeah. The frostbite is all the stuff we've been talking about leads to, any of those things: lack of food, lack of water, exposure, like just touching something cold. Can be lead to a contact frostbite. Any of that. Any of these sort of small mistakes, whether you happen to leave some food behind, or the classic is, I got a big block of cheese. Mm-hmm. Well, cheese freezes, so often you have this big block of frozen cheese that's really hard to deal with.
Chocolate'll do that too. Yeah. You get chocolate that it's like putting a stone in your mouth if it's completely frozen. It's not that great.
Yeah. And all that stuff, and I just really emphasize to everybody that preparation is so important. I like the saying, in winter, everything, just multiply it, everything by two. The cost, the time it takes to do things, the amount of preparation it takes, twice the amount of time. So everything just goes slower. So, don't expect to be, racing through the winter, at least the first few times you're out there. Take your time, prepare, and small incremental steps.
And practice. Yeah. I always encourage folks to become intimately familiar with their stoves and practice using it a lot in the comfort of their own home before they go out. And as you mentioned, don't ever touch any bare metal with your hand, bare hand.
Yeah, there's friends of mine that one guy says, never take your lino gloves off. So you just buy a cheap pair of lino gloves somewhere, and he says, just never take your gloves off, And it's a great little simple rule that helps prevent a lot of cold hands.
Yeah, yeah. So practicing with your stove, because if you do run into trouble, there's nothing that's going to help you as much as a warm drink, right?
Yeah. Yep.
I mean, and that's good advice for summer, too. If you fall in the water or get cold, be able to make hot chocolate or coffee or whatever it is you need to get yourself warmed up.
Yeah. And I've also become a big fan of these chemical heat packs. We issue them to all our students now, and, to have some toe warmers.
The ones that we hand out in junior Nordic, hot hands.
Yeah, hot hands, for the hands and the foot warmers. And the thing that I've been doing with those foot warmers lately that I really like, as I put, instead of they tell you to put them on the bottom of your feet, I've actually been putting them on the top of my toes, and they seem to work a little bit better. So,
and they're adhesive, so you can stick them on. I'm sure you have them at REI.
I sell them every day. I like to remind people, if you don't need them, you may run across someone else that really appreciates
you. Just carry
you
them in your pocket. Yeah.
And also remember, they do take some air and a slight bit of moisture to work. And if you put them in your footwear, you need to do it a little in advance to warm foot
shake
up. Because the disposable ones, if you put them in your footwear and lace up your shoe, you've cut off all the air.
Right. So you need to shake them and
but
get them
keep
ready.
That in mind. You can put them in a Ziploc bag, too, to shut them off until you need them later if you've only used them for an hour or something.
I never thought of that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, this was fun. I really appreciate you guys being here. Paul Twardock from APU. He's a professor and department chair of the Outdoor Studies Program. Mark Haldane at REI. Go in. Check it out. Maybe buy something from him. Earlier, we heard from Dave Acheson with Alaska Tent and Tarp, and Fiona Pichel from the Ski for Women. Next week, we're talking about ice fishing on Outdoor Explorer. Folks are out doing it right now all over Anchorage and out in the wilderness. We'll find out why and how on next week's show. Thanks for joining us today on Outdoor Explorer. Our producer is Kristen Platt. I'm your host, Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Outdoor Explorer and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.